You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. I'm Jim Collins. I am the director of the Russia-Eurasia program here at Carnegie. And we are very, very pleased today to have with us a distinguished speaker who can talk about one of the topics on the U.S.-Russian agenda probably with perspective and insight that few can bring to the topic. We are almost 20 years now from the beginning of the post-Soviet world and the post-Soviet state of the Russian Federation. And in that time, I don't think there's been a more continuing and, I would say, disputed topic than how Russia is doing in developing its market economy. It's a topic in which, during the 90s, I and a number of others were involved. America thought we were in the best position, perhaps, of any to assist Russia in developing the machinery of a market economy. And I remember being asked one day, in, probably in something like early 1992, by a senior minister in the Russian government, whether I could simply tell him how to do that, and could I give him one or two people who would help them make a market economy in a year or two. Well, that kind of development is well behind us, and Russia really does have a market economy. I used to insist on that as of January 1, 1992, it had a market economy. It was just one that had some rather peculiar features. And since then, U.S.-Russia relations, and particularly U.S.-Russia economic relations, have gone through many different phases. And in the last couple of 3 years, we have been in a phase of, I think, what has been productive and constructive development. The United States, through its creation of the Bilateral Presidential Commission, has devoted a number of working groups to finding ways to broaden and strengthen the economic relations between the two countries. And that is bearing a degree of fruit. More to the point, I suppose, we may even this year see the end to the WTO saga, one hopes. But all in all, America's relations in the economic sector have grown. They have been developing. Our trade is growing, though it still remains rather small. And so I am very pleased today that Undersecretary Robert Hormats has agreed to talk a little bit about the state of U.S.-Russia economic relations and where we may be going. Undersecretary Hormats became the Undersecretary of State for Economic, Energy, and Agricultural Affairs in September 2009. He was formerly the Vice Chairman of Goldman Sachs International. He joined Goldman Sachs in 1982, and before that, had served in a number of capacities in this town, including on the National Security Council staff, as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic and Business Affairs in the Department of State, and as the Assistant Secretary of State for Economic and Business Affairs. He was also Ambassador and Deputy U.S. Trade Representative from 1979 to 81. So, Bob, it is with great pleasure that we welcome you to Carnegie, and we look forward to your remarks. And after that, we can have some discussion with the audience.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jim, and I really appreciate the chance to speak to all of you about the subject that Jim and I actually have collaborated on together for a number of years. And it's also great to be back here at Carnegie, which does some really terrific work in this area and in many others. Dealing with issues relating to the Russian economy, for me, have a particular meaning since my career that Jim very kindly outlined started right in the middle of the Cold War when I joined Dr. Kissinger's staff as his economic advisor, in fact, one of three economic advisors in the early part of the Nixon administration, when, of course, Cold War issues were paramount, and virtually everything we did in the area of foreign policy had some bearing on or was driven to some measure by the Cold War. It's also the case that during that period, economic relations with Russia were about as close to zero as you can get. There was a very, very thin veneer of economic cooperation. As you may recall, the historians among you, after World War II, the extension of membership in the Marshall Plan included, at least in General Marshall's view and President Truman's view, including Russia and some of its allies, and the Soviet Union then decided it would not participate in the Marshall Plan. And not only did it fail to participate in the Marshall Plan, it insisted that other countries in Eastern Europe that were under Soviet influence not participate either. So for a long period of time, Russia's goal, or the Soviet goal at that point, was to minimize economic relations with the West and the United States, and to belittle, or in some cases try to undermine, the major global institutions that had been set up after the war: the Marshall Plan, the OECD, the IMF, the World Bank, the GATT. These were considered anathema to the Soviet Union, and not only did it not join, as I say, it tried to dissuade others from joining. Things, needless to say, have changed very dramatically, and Russia is in the IMF. It is in the World Bank. It is playing a very active role, although it's not a full member of the OECD. It has joined the OECD Anti-Bribery Convention, as I mentioned, as I will describe a little bit later. And it's not in the WTO yet, but it's working hard to get there. So we're really in a very different world from the one I and Jim and others started out in several decades ago. But I will talk a little about the economic side of this equation and what it means and where I think we're going. As you probably have read in the paper, President Obama and President Medvedev met in Deauville on the margins of the G8 meeting last month. And I was one of the Sherpas that worked on this meeting, so I had the opportunity to be up in Deauville and sort of watch the and participate to a degree in the proceedings there. And as you doubtless also know, their conversations included the traditional issues that you would expect the President of Russia and the President of the United States to discuss, which included the Middle East and North Africa. It included ways to accelerate cooperation on missile defense, a wide range of security issues. But they also discussed an area which I would like to focus on today, and which received a considerable amount of attention in the bilateral conversation that both of them had, and that was the economic engagement between Russia and the United States, and the role that Russia was going to be playing in the global system, which would particularly include the focus on the WTO. Our engagement on Russia on economic issues, I think is fair to say, when you look at the numbers and you look at the intensity of discussions, is accelerating. And I think this is seen by both sides as to our mutual benefit. There have been and continue to be many positive changes taking place in Russia with regard to economic development. After experiencing serious after effects from the global financial crisis, and during that period, declines in oil prices, the Russian government knows better than ever that modernization, innovation, and diversification of the Russian economy beyond its traditional natural resource base and dependence on natural resource exports are keys to sustainable and balanced economic growth. President Medvedev has placed a very, very high priority, as he mentioned in Deauville, and he has mentioned in virtually every speech he gives, on modernizing the economy, with a particular focus on five major sectors. One of them is energy efficiency, another is nuclear technology, a third is telecom and information technology, a fourth is aerospace, and a fifth is pharmaceutical products. The U.S. is also working in partnership with Russia on a number of those issues and on the broader issue that President Medvedev also discusses, which is greater Russian integration in the global economy. The goal of the cooperation between us is to encourage Russia to play that greater role in the global economy that the president talks about and many other Russian leaders talk about, because we have, as part of our broader objective of broadening the benefits and the responsibilities for a well-functioning international trading system and economic system, the goal of bringing more and more countries into that system. The key to balance, the key to growth, the key to stability in the global economy in the 21st century is for the emerging economies, particularly the BRICS, not only to benefit from the global economic system, but to assume greater responsibilities for that system. That includes China, India, Brazil, and certainly Russia. And as part of that overall goal of sharing benefits and sharing responsibilities, we support Russia's accession to the WTO. And I'm pleased to say that Russia's WTO accession is on a positive track in Geneva. The White House will also work with Congress this year to seek Jackson-Vanik graduation and the granting of permanent normal trade relations to Russia, given the positive momentum of Russia's WTO accession and the benefits to U.S. interests and to our relationship with Russia from these steps. We also support the process of Russia's eventual accession to the OECD when it meets the necessary conditions for full membership. As I mentioned, Russia has been working with the OECD in a number of areas, and many of them have achieved very positive results. We see this, again, as part of a progressive series of events to enable Russia to play a greater part in the global economic system. We see that as benefiting us, and we see it as benefiting Russia as well. We're also very pleased with the progress that has been made to advance our renewed focus on innovation as a tool of economic engagement with Russia. There are many areas in which we can partner with the Russians, and I will discuss a number of those. In Deauville, Presidents Obama and Medvedev announced the intent of their governments to cooperate on such issues as biomedical research, smart grid technology, clean energy, and to deepen cooperation among the agencies protecting the Bering Sea. But while Russia strives to modernize, it is also fair to say that state-controlled or state-supported companies continue to play a dominant role in Russia's economy in many ways. This, and I think it's important to recognize this could be a problem if the playing field is not level between these companies and their competitors in the United States, their competitors in other countries, and indeed also competitors in Russia itself frequently are disadvantaged if the Russian government provides support to preferred companies, leaving others outside and struggling to obtain capital or markets or regulatory benefits. We have recently seen, for instance, some private banks in Russia decide to close down their retail operations. They reportedly found it hard to compete when state-controlled banks have nearly two-thirds of the market share. And this is just one example of distortions that occur when you have a large amount of state enterprises and other companies or enterprises trying to compete with them. Despite the state's heavy presence in the economy, however, I'm nonetheless encouraged by the overall policy direction coming from Moscow. We see policy changes that, if implemented, would help to unleash Russia's entrepreneurial power. Russia is working to meet the global high-level standards of the WTO, and that would certainly be helpful. These measures would support the further evolution of rules-based, market-oriented, and transparent policies within Russia and Russia's enhanced development and economic growth. But many potential challenges also remain. The IMF, and perhaps many of you have read this report, the IMF highlighted some of these in its press release last week when it pointed out that policy changes, including governance reforms and decisive privatization, are absolutely necessary for diversification and growth in the Russian economy. I commend that report to you. I'm sure it's widely read in Moscow by those who are studying ways in which they can make improvements in their own economy. Let me now talk a little bit about the modernization agenda and the innovation agenda and how we're working together specifically in those areas. Continued reforms that address Russia's modernization and innovation challenges will be critical for the Russian economy. And President Medvedev has been saying this for quite some time, and I think it is a very telling point. Vice President Biden made it clear in his speech at Moscow State University that political and economic modernization had to go hand in hand. Institutional challenges and movements to support democracy and the rule of law need to be a key priority if Russia is to move forward effectively. These changes that are required also support intellectual property rights and transparency to provide the environment for Russia to unleash its own competitive forces, including taking better advantage of its highly educated workforce. Those elements of property rights and transparency are critically important if the modernization, if the technological improvements that Russia wants and that the president has talked about are to take place, and as I say, to unleash the potential entrepreneurial capabilities operate within Russia. And you can see this when you go to universities and talk to college students and talk to young business people. In this context, I see a number of opportunities as well as a number of challenges. On the positive side, economic modernization is finally front and center on the Russian government's agenda. We've seen concrete evidence of its commitment in this area over the last 2 years. As was announced at Deauville, I will be leading a bilateral presidential commission working group on innovation, and my partner and co-chairman will be President Medvedev's economic advisor, Arkady Dvorkovich, who has been working on this and, as many of you know, is sort of a champion of innovation and entrepreneurialism in Russia. He's also the guy who beat the IBM chess-playing machine, Big Blue, at chess. So he is an innovative guy in his own right and quite interested in this. Also went to Duke University, so he has a good idea of how the research triangle in North Carolina works. And he's been working with a lot of entrepreneurs in Russia to make this kind of change or these kinds of changes that I've been mentioning. The working group that we will head will help sort through a range of bilateral activities that we are going to be addressing and determine how best to assist in particular in developing Skolkovo, Russia's new technology city, where U.S. companies have committed already over $1 billion. We need to collaborate here not only because the Russians would like more collaboration, as they certainly would, but also because success will have a demonstration effect on the rest of Russia. If Skolkovo can do well and if American companies can be supportive of and play a role in Russian technology innovation in this area, it can have broader effects in improving the openness and the entrepreneurial environment and the rights and responsibilities of entrepreneurs throughout Russia. It is also very important that President Medvedev in April set concrete deadlines for implementation of 10 measures aimed at improving Russia's investment climate. However, to expand on my earlier point, on state intervention, the modernization process will inevitably be hampered by continued distortive state involvement in the economy. This involvement tends to bestow benefits on state-owned or state-supported industries to the detriment of other competitors, both foreign and domestic. State involvement also extends to protectionism in agriculture, with grain tariffs and non-trade barriers to protect domestic production, as well as in industry, with investment regulations in the automotive sector that go against WTO rules. Around the world, we have been advocating for competitive neutrality in countries with industries or companies that receive heavy state support via preferential tax treatment, finance, or regulatory treatment, or enjoy privileged market access. Enterprises that are not state-owned or state-supported, in particular small and medium-sized enterprises, find themselves in a very difficult position in this arena if markets are distorted by heavy support for state-owned or state-supported enterprises. This discrimination, either de facto or de jure, makes it harder for them to do business, harder for them to employ people, and harder for them to obtain capital. A level playing field is important as Russia seeks foreign direct investment for its modernization and infrastructure needs. Investment will not come in sizable amounts if the environment is biased in favor of a certain group of companies. The OECD is working on developing a set of principles, in essence, mutually reinforcing policy recommendations involving trade, investment, competition, and corporate governance policies to ensure a level playing field for all competitors. We believe that Russia and other emerging economies would benefit from adhering to these types of principles. Now let me turn to the issue of the WTO and PNTR, which is a very timely one in Russia and a very timely one in Washington. Russia's eventual WTO accession is one area where the United States' interests and Russian interests largely coincide. With the WTO covering 95% of the world's trade, it is clear why Russia has persevered in its quest to accede to the WTO. It is certainly also inconvenient for our exporting companies, our manufacturers, and our farmers that one of the major economies of the world remains outside the bounds of normal trading rules. The United States fully supports Russia's aspiration to join the WTO, and our trade experts have consulted with Russia extensively to move accession negotiations forward toward the finish line. It is encouraging to hear statements from Russian leaders, such as President Medvedev's remarks on June 10, that there is a very high chance for membership this year. Also, I note the importance of Prime Minister Putin's recent remarks in a government meeting making the case for WTO accession for Russia. Ultimately, the pace of completing the final steps of the multilateral process depend upon Russia's determination, creativity, and its flexibility. In Russia's bilateral negotiations with Georgia, the administration is pleased that both sides have engaged in talks, thanks to the mediation of Heidi Grau, who is the Swiss mediator in this process. We're hoping that the mediator's assistance can help enable them to quickly resolve the trade-related issues between them in a way that benefits both countries. As Russia looks to attract foreign investment, prevent capital flight, and promote innovation in a globalized society and a globalized economy, these negotiations and these talks take on greater and greater importance. Many senior officials in Moscow see the need to offer business the certainty that it will abide by the same rules of the road in trade that apply to the overwhelming majority of the world economy. Russian leaders know that they must offer competitive conditions and play by global rules in order to attract more and more diversified investment. The reduction in barriers to foreign direct investment in the services sector alone could increase Russia's annual GDP by over 3%. The stability of faithful WTO compliance, while not a panacea, is a very important consideration for the international businesses that Russia needs to attract in order to see its modernization efforts become a reality. Observers of Russia who may not follow trade issues closely in other contexts sometimes pick up on occasional negative comments from some Russians toward the WTO, and we see these in the paper periodically. These observers cast doubt upon Moscow's commitment or imply that somehow the United States wants Russia's accession more than Russia itself. I hope that these critics would consider that crafting solid trade agreements never fails to generate some measure of opposition. It does so in virtually every agreement that has been negotiated over the course of time. But it is, in the final analysis, interests that matter. And many leading Russian opinion makers recognize that membership is in their overall national interest. Even though Russia as a whole clearly will gain from WTO accession, however, the benefits will not be spread uniformly to every single Russian citizen. And that's true with all trade agreements. We can't expect it to be otherwise. It's certainly true in every other country as well. Naturally, some would rather play it safe rather than heed the imperative of modernization and rising to global competitive challenges. We can see this in our own country as well. We must keep faith with our own workers in instances where trade expansion requires adjustments. Take the President's National Export Initiative, a goal of doubling exports over 5 years to support 2 million jobs. To reach this goal, we will need to do a number of things, including ratify trade agreements with Colombia, Korea, and Panama in short order. However, movement toward these goals and moving forward on these three pending trade agreements must be accompanied by a robust renewal of trade adjustment assistance, so-called TAA. There should be no need for adjustments in the United States due to Russia's WTO accession, however, and I think that's the point that needs to be made. Russia's WTO accession does not mean what it means, what agreement to other kinds of trade agreements might mean for the United States. It does not require any additional adjustments on our part once Russia joins the WTO. It's a factor that tends to get lost sometimes when this issue gets caught up in a lot of other things that are going on with respect to trade. There is no need for any new adjustments on the part of the United States if Russia were to join the WTO. As a current WTO member, we need to make no new concessions as part of this process. In fact, Russia's accession to the WTO would actually bring new opportunities for U.S. exporters and U.S. workers. Russia is the world's 10th largest economy, but only our 37th largest export market. Its expanding middle class will likely soon make Russia the largest retail market in Europe. Russian accession to the WTO will provide America's farmers and ranchers with improved access to Russia's 140 million consumers. Its accession will likely create new opportunities in one of the world's fastest growing markets by reducing and binding tariffs for many agricultural products, thereby providing more predictability for U.S. exporters. Furthermore, WTO rules should reduce the perceived arbitrary and capricious trade barriers that have been imposed over the past couple of years on U.S. meat and poultry exports to Russia. Similarly, accession will afford improved opportunities for our manufacturers and our service providers. So these are some general observations that I would like to make on the whole question of WTO. I also think that we need to recognize that Russia plays a very important role as a BRIC country, and that the Russian people themselves are highly educated and increasingly demand high-quality products that the United States can export. And I think that if we look at the overall scope of our trade relations with Russia and use independent estimates, our exports to Russia could double after WTO accession. So when we look at Russia, we look at the BRICS, and we look at export opportunities for the United States, Russia joining the WTO provides important benefits for the United States. But for U.S. companies to take full advantage of Russia's WTO accession, Congress must do something, and must do something relatively quickly, and that is first grant the president the authority to extend permanent normal trade relations to Russia. This requires terminating the application of the Jackson-Vanik Agreement Amendment to Russia. The reasons for this legislation are in the distant Cold War past. The issue that triggered it, freedom of immigration, no longer exists and has not existed for many, many years. If we fail to grant permanent normal trade relations to Russia, we're not hurting the Russians. We're hurting our manufacturers, we're hurting our farmers, and we're hurting our workers. There are legitimate concerns over human rights in Russia, but freedom of immigration is not one of them. In fact, Russia and Israel now offer each other citizens visa-free travel. Jackson-Vanik was not designed to provide the U.S. government with the leverage over Russia on other matters. It was designed to deal with that issue, and that issue, as I say, is in the distant Cold War past. Before taking a vote on Jackson-Vanik, Congress will, however, want to see, among other things, that U.S. farmers, ranchers, service providers, and manufacturers can sell to Russia without facing anti-competitive restrictions. Congress will also look to see whether Russia follows up on its passage of WTO-consistent legislation on intellectual property rights with robust enforcement. The WTO accession process already has spurred positive developments in Russia's IPR regime, and we expect that membership in the WTO, as well as Russia's interest in attracting investment in the innovation sector, will support continued progress. As President Obama has affirmed, the administration will work with Congress this year to try to terminate Jackson-Vanik and extend permanent normal trade relations for Russia. Certainly, the legislative agenda is crowded, but this change is hardly radical, given that we have granted Russia's goods most favored nation treatment for 16 years in a row now. Let me conclude very briefly. A great deal of work has been done to enable Russia's accession to the WTO to take place. Negotiators will be back toiling in Geneva shortly to make maximum progress before August. We in Washington will watch this process closely, and of course our negotiators and our people in Geneva are involved in it. Hard work lies ahead, but the light at the end of the tunnel is far brighter than it has been in the past. We need to focus attention on finding solutions to the tough issues that have eluded us and which will pave the way for improved trade and investment relations going forward. At the same time, we need to enhance cooperation on areas like innovation and science and technology, where we can work together now for our mutual benefit and for the benefit of the global economy. A Russia that is more integrated into the global economy, which supports and adheres to its rules, will strengthen the international economy, the Russian economy, and the American economy. Thus, it should be a high priority for Moscow, as it is here in Washington. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Bob, for the overview and a sense for the priorities that we're going to be pursuing as we go forward in the coming months. I'd like at this point, if you have some time, for the audience to get a chance to ask you some questions. And so I think I will simply start with the audience. What I do want is for people to identify themselves and use the microphone. So microphones are around, and we can start. So can we start right here? Here's your mic.
Thank you. Jim Bird of Washington Trade Daily. Just a simple question.
Your questions are never simple. They start out that way, but they don't end up that way.
Just in your reference to Russian legislation that's already passed, GATT-compliant public, like IPR. Mm-hmm. The issue of enforcement, I assume the issue of TRQs for agriculture and SPS issues for agriculture. Does Russia have to present a track record before it enters the WTO, or could that wait and then be open to formal challenges? I mean, or both?
Told you these questions are never simple. Russia, the assumption is that when Russia passes legislation, it complies with the legislation. Let's take the WTO, the IPR question. And the assumption is, having passed the legislation, it will comply with that legislation. That's the one that they have moved the furthest on. And as I say, I think more importantly, the Congress will be watching this. And I say this not just to point the finger at Russia and say, you need to do this. They've made this commitment by passing the legislation, and implementing the legislation would be a very strong signal about willingness to implement other aspects of the commitments they make when they join the WTO. I'd make a second point, and that is that I actually think that if you go back to other countries that have joined the WTO or the GATT before that, there is a very, once that kind of legislation is passed, whether it's IPR protection or other things, once you do this, a constituency builds up in the country for implementing it in the following sense, that a lot of Russian companies want Russia to join the WTO, and of course they want PNTR. So they're going to be, in effect, watching this just as carefully as we will. The second point is that they need to attract foreign investment, and they need to diversify their economy. The financial experts in Russia, and I think most people in a strong policy-making role, understand that their very heavy dependence on hydrocarbon exports, oil and gas, is very nice now because prices are quite high, although not in gas. There's more competition, as you know, as sort of our shale, our fracking backs out Qatari gas, and Qatari gas goes into Russia and Western Europe and competes with Russian gas. But nonetheless, prices are still relatively high. So they understand that, having seen the past, prices could go down again. And they understand, particularly you hear Finance Minister Kudrin and others talk about this, and the Prime Minister as well, and the President certainly, talk about the reliance on that sector as a major source of export revenues and, of course, a major source of tax revenues. They understand the importance of diversification, and therefore, if they're going to diversify, they want to diversify in areas where they have a comparative advantage. They have a comparative advantage in brain power. Russian universities churn out enormous numbers of highly talented scientists, engineers, computer scientists. I mean, Jim knows this far better than I do. And they have the opportunity, and that's why Skolkovo is such an interesting opportunity. They have an opportunity to use their brain power, but they're not going to be able to use the brain power as much if they don't protect intellectual property. And therefore, I think that, A, it will be looked at in the run-up period to the Jackson-Vanik vote, but also internally, I think a lot of Russians will be focusing on this issue as well. Do you want anything? Does that make...
No, I think that makes... I would agree. I think you've given a very sort of comprehensive view of it. Yes, please. There you
go. Thank you. Andrei Sito from TASS, from the Russian news agency. First, thank you to Carnegie for hosting the event, arranging the event, and thank you, Ambassador, for taking part in the event, for speaking. Basically, two quick questions, perennial, I guess, questions. The Russians keep saying that the partners are giving them additional, keep giving them additional requirements, additional conditions. They say it goes beyond whatever was required of the previous ones. And secondly, the Russians, they just concluded St. Petersburg Forum, basically, I think, took a hard line on this issue. Nebiulina said that unless we resolve all the outstanding issues in July, by August, it can lead to drawing this process out for years.
No.
So my question to you is, how realistic is it to expect the outstanding issues to be resolved in July, and what does the administration want to do with the Congress to do that? Thanks.
Well, there you've actually asked three questions. One, first of all, are we asking of Russia terms that we're not asking for anyone else? Our view is we're not asking Russia any more than we're asking other countries, or any less than we're asking other countries. There's a fairly clear set of requirements to join the WTO, and we are not discriminating against or making additional demands on Russia that we wouldn't make for any comparable country. Let me add to this point, and then I'll get to the timing point. And let me say why we think it's in our interest to work these things out with Russia. So we have no interest in imposing barriers that go beyond the what we would ask of other countries. We have found Russia, and you know, I've had numerous conversations with Minister Nebiulina, who is very, very good and a very good negotiator, and knows this stuff extremely well. We've worked very effectively with Russia in every other global institution where we are together. I'm the foreign affairs Sherpa, Sue Sherpa in the G8. We work very closely with Russia in the G8. We find ourselves in agreement with Russia on a large number of things. The same is true of the G20, where we work very closely with Russia. And in fact, a number of initiatives within the Sherpa process in both of those are Russian-U.S. joint ideas or joint proposals. We work very closely with Russia in the IMF and the World Bank. A lot of cooperation on a whole range of issues. So we have no reason to believe that we wouldn't have a very high level of cooperation with Russia in the WTO, because we've become used to working with one another. And it's not only is it a comfortable process, several initiatives that came out of the Deauville G8 summit were U.S.-Russian co-sponsored. We've worked together on terrorism, for instance, several elements together. So we have an interest in Russia joining. We also have an interest in Russia joining a rules-based international system, which is what the WTO is at the center of. The second issue is with respect to the timing question. As you get to the end of a negotiation, and I hope we're getting to the end of a negotiation, I was very encouraged by the statement, I think it was President Medvedev's statement, that we thought this could be done by the end of the year. I think there's a reasonably good possibility it could be done by the end of the year. And in fact, if all the issues are resolved, that is not an unreasonable or unrealistic possibility. We don't want it to extend. Whether it can be done by July, I don't know. I'm not in Geneva doing the negotiating. But I would say that If we can get it done by the end of the year, that would certainly be something we would like to see, and I believe Moscow would like to see that too. And then you get the third part of your question that you sort of added on at the end is, what about the Congress? The Congress's direct role will be not so much in the negotiations of the WTO, although we keep in touch with them on this, but on PNTR, Jackson-Vanik. And one of the things we're trying to do is keep Congress up to date on the WTO conversations, but also explain why the lifting of Jackson-Vanik makes sense for the reasons I've just tried to describe in my statement. So we want to work. We want to work with the Congress on this. If you look at the reasons for Jackson-Vanik in the 70s, those reasons no longer exist. As I say, they're in the mists, the distant mists of the Cold War. The reasons for that legislation no longer exist. As I say, there's a lot of travel between Israel and Russia. Are there issues with Russia? Yes, there are issues with Russia, but is Jackson-Vanik the appropriate legislative framework for addressing those? We don't think so.
Yes.
Thank you. Keith Henderson, American University. I'm wondering, shouldn't there also be a presidential working group on the cross-cutting issues of corruption and the rule of law? I'm not sure a lot of progress can be made in the other working groups unless those issues are addressed. And second, with regard to the IMF recommendation for more privatization, do you really think that's going to work given the way privatization has worked in Russia in the past? Thanks.
Well, on the first point, we discussed the corruption, other issues on a fairly regular basis with Russia. So whether there's a need for another working group, I don't know that there is. This is part of the general conversation. But let me make a very important point here. That is, Russia understands this issue very well. And Russia has just signed the anti-bribery convention code of the OECD. They got it through the Duma. Got support in the Duma. Minister Nabulina was really the person who pushed this very hard. I actually think that while issues do exist, a lot of progress has been made on that issue. Again, for the reason that if you want to attract foreign investment in Russia, and you want to strengthen Russian, leave aside foreign investment, you want to strengthen Russian investment in Russia, then dealing with a lot of these issues is in Russia's interest to do. So I don't think that is it is certainly an issue. I don't think it is an issue that the Russian government is ignoring. And in fact, Russian leaders speak of this on a fairly regular basis. Now, there are some areas where they could be making more progress, but it's not as if they're ignoring it, and it's not as if there hasn't been progress. I was very impressed, I must say, that they got the anti-bribery legislation code through the Duma very, very quickly. So I do think there is progress. There's room for more, but there's certainly progress. And we should really look at the prism through in I think a somewhat more encouraging way. I mean, there is skepticism about some of these areas in the United States. But I also say that when you talk to Russian officials, they understand in their own interests that progress on some of these things is critically important.
Yeah, Judith.
Judith Mandel, I'm an independent consultant. I have two questions, wildly different. First is, one of the things that would certainly facilitate cooperation with the Russians in some of the innovation and science and technology areas would be a reform of U.S. export controls, which were announced last year by Secretary Gates and the Undersecretary of State for
Townshend, right?
Yeah. And where does that stand? Because that is still a major obstacle for American companies who wish to do the kinds of things you're promoting.
Right.
And the second question is cooperation in nuclear issues is hampered by the lack of legislation on the Russian side to limit liabilities for nuclear damages. And their signature of the IAEA Convention on Supplementary Compensation for Nuclear Damages. Where do U.S. efforts with the Russians on those two issues stand? Thank you.
Well, let me just, the nuclear is an area that I really have not, it's really not under my jurisdiction. The export control thing really isn't either, but I can give you some sense of where that, I mean, that is, Russia isn't the only country that raises this issue, as you doubtless know. Other large countries do the same. We're in the process now, and this is a long process. There are very strong national security imperatives. On the other hand, we also know that there are items on the export control list that are available, you know, fairly easily on the shelves of most electronic stores. So, but sorting them out and creating the process for approvals has taken a lot of time, and I don't know how much more time it's going to take. We know that this process is a source of irritation to other countries, but also to certain American exporters who would like to be able to export more of these things. I can't tell you when the whole review is going to be complete, just that in fact that it is underway.
Yes. Oh, hi, Rich.
Thank you. Hi. Rich Harold with GE Transportation. That's the part of GE that produces locomotives. Last week, the president of Mongolia visited Washington, and I mention this because a lot of Mongolians see themselves as the meat in a sandwich with Russia on the top and China below. And recently, both Russia and China have been playing extreme hardball with Mongolia on trade and investment issues, particularly in the mining sector, various parts of infrastructure, and in the rail sector, locomotives. And so my question is it appropriate to raise with Russia, let's say through the Joint Commission, to that with China through the JCCT, issues of asking both countries to help keep a level playing field in Mongolia so that American companies can be competitive there? And what levers would the U.S. have, if any? I mean, is that even a realistic thing to do?
Well, the first part is it's certainly in our interest, and indeed we do constantly urge these countries to maintain a level playing field in their international trade. In other words, what we're trying to do is to identify ways in which they, in the way they deal with state enterprises in particular, because that's I think what you're referring to, is that they do not provide benefits for state enterprises that give them a competitive advantage over non-state enterprises or non-state supported enterprises. So, no, this is certainly something. It's not just in Mongolia, it's everywhere. I mean, one of the things that I've been working on a lot is this notion of competitive neutrality. And the competitive neutrality idea is that state supported or state owned enterprises do not get special benefits that give them an arbitrary competitive advantage, either financing or regulatory benefits or immunity from anti-monopoly provisions, things of that nature. So the answer to your question is certainly we should be doing this with China, we should be doing it with Russia, and not just vis-a-vis Mongolia, but with other countries as well. Part of it also relates to export financing. As you doubtless know, one of the big challenges EXIM has is competing with other countries. Well, of course, GE, you know that well. is competing with other countries who are willing to provide very generous export financing that is not does not fall under the so-called OECD consensus, and therefore we're pressing them all the time. What leverage do we have? In fact, in one particular case that you're probably aware of, China made a very competitive bid, largely because the bid was competitive because of very preferential export financing, and we agreed that Exim would match the China bid, and we won the contract. This is in Pakistan. So the answer is we have leverage, and the leverage is to fight these battles using the levers we have at home, Exim financing being one of them. The difficulty with that is it's expensive, and we're competing against countries, China, needless to say, that has a very deep pocket with respect to this kind of financing. So we aim to try to be as competitive as we can. We aim to fight where we can using whatever measures we can, export financing being one of them. And also in the WTO, where there are subsidies or whether there are artificial distortions that we can prove, or if there are, we're willing to go and launch those cases. But it is a very troublesome issue, this whole issue of how, and I think this is, you know, we're constantly looking at the State Department for the sort of 21st century issues where there are no agreed, fully agreed, or widely agreed rules. And dealing in this issue of competitive neutrality or dealing with state enterprises is one of them. It's not that there haven't been state enterprises before. There have since the French, in their sort of dirigiste mercantilist way in the 1700s, did these things, and the Dutch East India Company. These were all state enterprises, by and large. The difference is now there's a lot more money behind them, and people begin to think, well, this is a really good model. So we're working to try to convince them. First of all, it's not a very good model because it sucks the oxygen out of non-state enterprises in their own countries. And as I mentioned, that's the case in Russia. The second thing it does is, if you're a developing country and you think this is a good model, that the state should support your enterprises, you have to realize you're competing with China. And they have a lot more money than you do, wherever you are. So while it may seem like an attractive model in the short term, it's not a very attractive one in the longer term, and that's what we're trying to convey to these countries. But the answer is yes, we should be doing a lot about it, and we are.
Okay. Yes, please.
Len Bracken, BNA. You mentioned the Russian automotive industry in your remarks. Could you go into more detail about that, their opposition to the WTO and...
Well, it's not... I mean, it's the measures that... You're talking about the measures they've just taken?
You got a cell phone.
No, it's off.
It's off, okay. At least somebody's got a cell phone or a BlackBerry working, and it needs to be turned off.
It's all anyway. Okay. Are you talking about the recent measures they've taken on autos?
Not necessarily. I was thinking about the opposition to the WTO accession by the automotive industry.
That's a different. There are two things. One of the, they've done some recent things that have not been very helpful to our auto industry, some of you know, and then there's this broader point. I actually prefer not to get into the individual negotiations at this point. They're very sensitive, and I think commenting on individual industries and what they're saying and doing is probably not very productive. I have some views on it, but I don't think it's a good time to do it. My view generally is that the... there are always going to be industries that will like these agreements, and then there are always going to be some that have issues. And finding the right balance is really the critical part. And so talking about what individual industries want or don't want, it's probably not going to be helpful to the negotiations.
Yes, ma'am.
Marlene Davis, Motorola. Quick question about your views, if it's time to discuss that, about the Medvedev Putin relationship.
I'll leave that to people in Moscow, not me. As intriguing as it may be.
Yeah. Bob, I want to ask you a question about your working group on innovation. Mm-hmm. To what extent, well, let me put it another way. Innovation is fine. There are plenty of innovations going on in Russia in the minds of the people in the labs and so on. The problem is that they have not done very well at taking advantage of the innovative ideas to produce either businesses or commercialize them and so on. Is this part of what you're going to be taking up, or is, where does this concept fit?
Yes.
Because we don't hear much about it.
That's a good point. Also, we afterwards we ought to call this lady. She's had her hand up for a while, so but I'll answer your question. I think you've put it exactly right that there are plenty of innovative people. In fact, a recent Russian company just did an IPO that did quite well, and I actually visited them when I was in Moscow last time. I think the problem is this, and it goes back to the point you were making, can you find a few people who can tell us how to make a market economy? In a way, it's the same thing. Can you give us the magic elixir for creating an innovative economy? The answer, I think, is that innovation, there's a very interesting book by John Kao, called Innovation Nation. It's about the U.S., but he talks a lot about what kind of ecosystems you need in order to be innovative. And Russia has several attributes that could make it much more innovative. It has very bright, very talented people who, when given the chance, can also be very entrepreneurial. Where it has problems is that it's very hard for them to get capital. Getting capital in Russia for startup companies, VC companies, angel capital is very difficult in Russia. Second, the protection of intellectual property rights in Russia is very sketchy, and people are not going to put a lot of money or time into companies unless they think they can get the returns. Third, the notion of failure is really part of the ethic of success, ironically, in the business of innovation, because there are very few entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley or in the North Carolina Triangle or anywhere else who've not been in companies or started companies that have failed once or twice, and the third time they succeed. In Russia, that concept that you can fail and then come back doesn't seem to have taken hold, so it sort of stigmatizes you if you've failed before. Fourth, you've got a lot of very big state enterprise companies that, or state-supported companies that really are not particularly keen on having a lot of upstart companies there, and these upstart companies find it very difficult to get access to the government officials. I think that's changing, but I do think that it is a problem. In fact, I met with a number of entrepreneurs last year during the St. Petersburg Forum, and I said, "Well, you know, what could be helpful to you?" They said, we like a lot more access to government officials to tell them about the kind of things that we need in order to produce and grow companies, so that the kind of interaction that you get here between entrepreneurial companies and the government, which is quite robust, just doesn't exist in Russia. These are the kind of things that they need to change. And that is one of the things we're going to talk about in our innovation thing. Now, Skolkovo, the focus initially is going to be on Skolkovo, but largely because the model that they have for Skolkovo is not just to have this be a sort of a light on the hill, but to learn from it the kind of things that they can use in other parts of Russia to create similar things. If you look at Malaysia, the multimedia corridor in Malaysia, they have, you know, Intel, Microsoft, Sun Microsystems, all these companies in this little area of Malaysia, and they've done very well. And what's happened is that in other parts of the region, you've had similar groups. China's developing these sort of innovation cities, with the goal not just of developing the cities, but having the model being used elsewhere. And I think that's really what the Skolkovo idea is.
Karina Zinkiewicz, I'm from Oxbridge Congressional Policy Internship, and I'm studying Russian studies. So I have just one more question about privatization. There are different modes or methods of privatization, like sell to outsiders or management buyouts, employee buyouts. Do you think, is there a link between the mode of privatization and economic performance, or is there a link between mode of privatization and Russia's performance in world trade?
Well, I mean, without going to the whole history of Russian privatization that Jim knows a lot better than I do, I do think privatization, I don't know if there's any perfect model on privatization. I just don't think there is some, in some cases there's been sort of privatization in the hands of the management of the company that buys the company out. In other cases, privatization through a sort of IPO offering with the government still holding a certain share of it. In other cases, there's privatization where an anchor privatizer, like an oil company, buys a large share and then the rest of it is sold. I don't know that there's any perfect answer to your question. I think there are just a lot of ways you can do privatization. China, for instance, has privatized, or what they call privatization, but the government, in virtually every case that I'm aware of, holds a certain golden share of the company. But some of these companies have done very well with that model. I don't think that's, but it's certainly not true for all of them, and I'm not sure that it's a universally applicable model either.
Yeah, Wayne.
Wayne Mary, the American Foreign Policy Council. Assuming relatively timely WTO entry, how would you assess the significance for Russia of either success or perhaps more likely failure of the Doha round?
We're still struggling to complete the Doha round. I think that from the point of view of Russia, if we're just talking about Russia today, given the benefits of joining the WTO in terms of being part of a rules-based system, I would say that whether or not the Doha round succeeds or fails, the benefits for Russia of joining the WTO and for us of having them in the WTO are still quite great. I mean, Doha would make it a little bit better for everyone if it succeeded on the grounds that we're hoping, which is that the Chinese, the Brazilians, the Indians, and others open their markets. Russia would benefit from that along with the United States and others. If that was the case. But so it's certainly better for them if the Doha round succeeds along the lines that we have been pushing for. But if it doesn't, getting in is still a big plus for them.
No, not as a rationale for getting the WTO. Assume they get in the WTO. Is this a big deal for them or a small deal for them, whether it succeeds or fails?
I would say compared to the benefits they would get of joining the WTO, what do you, you're asking, is it a failure? What do you?
Is it a plus or minus?
It's certainly a plus, but it's certainly a plus compared to the benefits they would get anyway. It's not a critical difference. In other words, it makes it better for them, as for all countries, to have a successful WTO. But there are a lot of benefits for them of getting into the WTO, even if the Doha round fails. I don't know how to quantify it any better than that. I mean, are you looking for some, how much?
Is Russia likely to be a major beneficiary if Doha succeeds?
They will be a beneficiary along with every other country. Will they be a major beneficiary? Probably not. The reason is because, for the moment at least, they are exporting largely raw materials and oil and gas, and those really are not under the WTO anyway. Now, down the road, if they became a more diversified economy and they produce things that the Chinese and the Indians and the Brazilians might buy, then membership in the WTO would become more valuable to them. But if you said, if they became a member of the WTO tomorrow, would they benefit enormously by the success of the Doha round? Not a lot.
Yes.
Yes. You met Jack Garrity from Asia Society. You mentioned that you expect that U.S. trade with Russia would probably double once they enter the WTO. How do you feel that Chinese trade with Russia would be impacted?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. I don't really know how to answer it. The exports of Russian goods to China currently, we're talking about the current, would probably not change very much. Because what do they sell to China? They sell raw materials, oil, gas, military equipment, primarily. Virtually none of those will change very much. China, on the other hand, probably would benefit more in the Russian economy because of the kind of things they sell, which is manufactured goods and things like that. So I think from the point of view of Russia's exports to China, probably at the moment, it's really in a way the same answer to the earlier question. Would they benefit in the, at the current moment? Probably relatively little. If they diversified their economy and they joined the WTO and China had to apply WTO tariffs and other things to Russia, then I think Russia over a period of time would be able to sell more and more of its newly diversified manufactured goods to China. So in the medium term, it would be very beneficial to Russia. In the near term, probably not so much, just because of the nature of the composition of Russian exports.
We've got about 5 minutes, so let me take a couple or three questions, and then you can try to summarize. Let me start there in the back.
Adam B. Sudi from Inside U.S. Trade. Given the number of issues that Russia needs to resolve before accession can occur, and the chance that you know it may not occur this year, is it going to be a priority in 2012 for the U.S.? And also, given these issues that need to be resolved, well, I mean, you said it's likely this year, but I mean, is there...
And our hope is this year.
Hope is this year. Is there any reason to think that Russia may not be able to meet some of those commitments that are expected, especially in...
It was President Medvedev who said it was likely this year, but our we actually think... The direct answer to your question is, it is there are difficult issues, no question. There's no point in minimizing them, but Russia has solved a lot of the issues that were out there a year ago. If you had said year and a half ago, would we be this far along in the negotiations? Very few people would have thought we would have been. So a lot of progress has been made, and I think that tends to get underestimated. I also think that there is a reasonable chance, indeed somewhat better than reasonable chance, that these issues can be resolved this year. But as I said in my speech, work still needs to be done, and these issues have to be, the remaining issues have to be addressed. Can they be addressed? There's no reason why they cannot be addressed in a timely way to allow this to happen this year. But decisions, tough decisions, still have to be made.
Okay, last question here.
Thank you very much. You mentioned military equipment as part of Russian trade with China. I wonder how much military equipment goes under the rules of WTO. I don't
very little.
Oil, gas.
Well, that's my point. No, that's my point, that if you look, let's take the China thing, the China point. If you look at what Russia, China, what are these negotiations about? I'm simplifying it, but they're about improved what's called NAMA, non-agricultural manufactured goods. It's called NAMA. That's the term that's used in the WTO. It's manufactured goods and agricultural goods and services. Russia's exports of those to anyone are not really very great. You know that better than I do. So it's not that they do export some manufactured goods, but as a portion of overall exports, it's not great. And therefore, expanding the coverage to more manufactured goods or lowering the tariffs, which China would do if it met the kind of criteria we would like it to for the success of the Doha round, wouldn't have, relatively speaking, to a degree it would benefit Russia, but relatively speaking, since a lot of the Russian exports are raw materials, nickel, you know, gas and oil, particularly if a new pipeline's put up, and then some military goods, almost none of those are going to be benefiting from the lower tariffs or the lower barriers. It just, the composition of Russian exports is just much different, which is, you know, the Russians know this. But on the other hand, and this is really the hope for the future, and that is Russia wants to diversify its economy. And if you look at it just from a static point of view, you would say Russia really wouldn't benefit very much. If you look at it from a dynamic point of view, which is the way you really have to look at these things to make it a meaningful judgment on the benefits, if you look at it from a dynamic point of view, Russia has the potential to diversify its economy a great deal. It has, certainly, as I say, the brain power. I mean, Russian scientists, physicists, chemists, physicians are, you know, computer scientists are among the very best in the world. I've been to Russian companies, and I was on the board of the U.S.-Russian Enterprise Fund for a number of years, so I had a lot of chance to talk to people in Russian companies. These are mostly small, medium-sized companies, but they were very entrepreneurial people. And my view is that joining the WTO is a good thing because it will enable a lot of these entrepreneurial companies in Russia that are not oil and gas companies or military companies to have a much broader set of market opportunities than they do now, and with a high degree of certainty about market access that they would get if they joined the WTO. And so I would say if you look at it over a 5 to 10 year time horizon, it's beneficial to the diversification of the Russian economy that President Medvedev, and I mentioned in my speech, the President Medvedev has been talking about, and Prime Minister Putin just mentioned it recently as another reason for joining the WTO. So over a 5 to 10 year period, it can be enormously beneficial. And then just let me say, from an American point of view, and this I'll close on this, as I say, our goal, and I think it's important to look at what we're doing in Russia. It's controversial. There's some people say, well, why are you so interested in Russia joining the WTO and all that. The basic point here is that in the 21st century, the goal of the United States is to find ways of encouraging more and more countries, particularly the BRICS and other large emerging economies, to play a greater role in the rules-based, market-oriented global economic system, which means that they not only benefit from it, which many of them are already, but that they assume greater responsibility for its success, which means adhering to the rules of the system and supporting the rules of the system in the way they conduct their policies. And I think that if you can, we've worked with Russia a lot on many issues in the IMF, World Bank, as I mentioned, G20, G8. And I think there's every reason to believe that we would work well with Russia if it were a member of the WTO. in helping to shape the global economy of the 21st century. And it's better from our point of view to have Russia in this rules-based system and contributing to it than outside the rules-based system. So that's why I said in my speech that this is an area where I think our interests converge. They may not converge on every issue. Certainly there are differences of opinion on some issues. But the broad thrust is one, and if we where I think the interests do converge.
Undersecretary Hormats, thank you very much for
thank you.
A great discussion. And thank you all for coming.